told me, "The last thing we need to do now is reorganize and create a big new department." But many members of Congress, of both parties, thought Ridge's office was not enough. Their confidence in the office was weakened early on when anthrax began appearing in the U.S. mail, and the Bush administration's response seemed confused. It was confused. Ridge and Attorney General John Ashcroft competed over who should coordinate the response, while Health Secretary Tommy Thompson's television appearances left many Americans less reassured and more alarmed. Republicans and Democrats in Congress objected to the White House's unwillingness to let Ridge appear before congressional committees because White House staff do not do that. Some in Congress noted that as national coordinator, I had appeared before 9 congressional committees to brief them on counterterrorism and domestic preparedness. President Bush completely changed his position and announced the urgent need for what he called the Homeland Security Act. Although delayed by the administration's insistence that civil servants' job rights be limited, the Homeland Security Act passed and the department was created. The outcome, as the Washington Post revealed in a major review in September 2003, has been a disappointing and disorganized mess. Much of the leadership was chosen for political loyalties, not executive branch experience. There were inadequate resources to effect a smooth merger. The White House-led Transition Planning Office produced few useful plans. Many key career staff left in disgust. Those who stayed often complained that they were actually less able to work on the substantive programs to increase security because the new department was poorly run. There are so few institutional support mechanisms to help them, and they need to spend so much time on the administrative challenges of reorganization. 22 agencies were simultaneously merged into the new department, into an organization that itself did not exist prior to the merger. The first few initiatives of the new department, rather than make us feel more secure, became material for late-night comics. The color code system initially caused state and local authorities to spend millions of dollars that they did not have to respond to changes in the color, changes that were unaccompanied by any detailed threat information shared with local authorities. States and cities began to announce that they would no longer respond to changes in the color code. Then came the announcement that all American homes should have duct tape, which quickly caused fearful Americans to clean out their hardware stores of a variety of types of 3M tapes. The Transportation Security Administration has also been underfunded to the point where the department proposed it would have to reduce the number of federal air marshals on aircraft, only to withdraw the proposal just days later because of public criticism. The Congress changed the administration's proposed legislation creating the department, adding detail and specificity about roles and missions. One mission about which the Congress was very clear was the need for a new center in the department to see and analyze all information available to the government on terrorist threats and be a second opinion. The FBI and CIA both saw this congressional mandate as a challenge to their authority. Although often at odds and unwilling to share information about terrorism with each other, the CIA and FBI can make common cause when faced with the same bureaucratic enemy. Thus, they proposed the creation of a CIA-FBI entity to analyze terrorist information. The list of important analytical failures by the CIA is now too long for us to conclude that the current system is acceptable. It is time now to do what so many veteran observers of the intelligence community have recommended: remove the intelligence analysis function from CIA and establish a small, independent bureau with a staff of career professionals and outside experts. As to the behemoth Department of Homeland Security, it is now too late to do a phased-in implementation of the department, as should have been done, but not too late to make the department work. The Homeland Security mission is too important to wait. It must become the place where senior managers want to work, the GE of the government. To bring about this metamorphosis will cost money. Regrettably, the administration sought to do Homeland Security on the cheap, telling Ridge that creating the new department had to be revenue neutral, jargon for no new money to implement the largest government reorganization in history. Before and after September 11th, the Security Service mission in the United States belonged to the FBI. The FBI had responsibility for finding terrorists and often seemed unable to find al-Qaeda in the U.S. prior to September 11th, or even to find the right-wing domestic terrorist who bombed the Atlanta Olympics and several other targets. Bob Mueller, a federal prosecutor, arrived as the new head of FBI just days before September 11th. He cannot be blamed for the failure of the Bureau to find al-Qaeda or even to have a computer network prior to then. Much of that responsibility belongs to his predecessor. Since September 11th, Mueller has tried to reorient the organization from post-crime investigation to prevention, from drugs and bank robbery to terrorism. In 2002, Dale Watson, the FBI's leading counterterrorism official, retired. Months later, Watson's replacement asked to be reassigned, and a third person became the executive assistant director for counterterrorism. Within 2 months, the next incumbent retired, and the post was vacant again. Without steady, top leadership in charge of counterterrorism, the Bureau has not been fully able to make the transition from post-crime investigation to prevention and analysis. As Dale Watson discovered in 2000, it is hard to turn around a bureaucracy that's been heading in another direction for years. Watson's attempts prior to September 11th met with resistance, even from the Attorney General. John Ashcroft had denied Watson's request for more counterterrorism funds because counterterrorism was not one of the three priorities of the Ashcroft Justice Department. The reality in America is that there are two big hurdles to the creation of a new, effective security service. The first is the right-left political alliance against security measures, and the second is the FBI itself. The right-left political alliance is the phenomenon in which organizations like the National Rifle Association and the American Civil Liberties Union come together, usually with congressmen like Dick Armey, to express concern at efforts to strengthen the hand of domestic security officials. Any legislation proposing a security service will be met by a barrage of critics even before they read the bill. The FBI, which does not want to lose the domestic security mission to some new agency, will also work hard in the media and with the Congress to scuttle any legislation. These hurdles do not mean that the security service should not be pursued. The best path at the present is to create the security service within the FBI, a service within a service, with a new spirit. To ensure that the security service does not fall into the abuses of the J. Edgar Hoover era, there must be active oversight by a board of Americans, all of whom inspire trust and confidence from the vast majority of our citizens. John Ashcroft, before September 11th, had refused to increase counterterrorism funds and had not placed terrorism in the top priority issues for the Justice Department. When I and one of my staff met with Ashcroft early in the administration, we were left wondering if his discussion with us had been an act. My associate asked me on the drive back to the White House, "He can't really be that slow, can he? I mean, you can't get to be Attorney General of the United States and be like that, right?" I wasn't sure. "I don't know," I said. "Maybe he's just cagey." But after all, he did lose a Senate re-election to a dead man. After the attacks, and armed with the USA Patriot Act, Ashcroft so mismanaged the important perceptions component of the war on terrorism at home that he became a symbol to millions of Americans of someone attacking rather than protecting our civil liberties. There is an obvious tension between domestic security and civil liberties. We know that al-Qaeda and similar groups have figured out and use our system against us, applying for refugee status or political asylum, hiding in religious and charitable institutions, communicating on the internet. To protect our civil liberties and defeat the terrorists, we need to be careful not to do things that create a popular backlash against security measures. As widespread opposition to the unfortunately named Patriot Act proves, Attorney General Ashcroft has not managed that balancing act. Critics of all methods of improving domestic security must, however, also be cautious. If our domestic security organizations do not have the appropriate skills, staff, technology, and authorities they need, there may be more terrorist disasters in this country. The congressional and popular response to another round of major terrorist disasters in the U.S. could seriously threaten our civil liberties. Because the Department of Homeland Security was not given the role of a domestic security service, nor allowed to do the congressionally mandated task of a second opinion on terrorism analysis, one would have thought that at least it would assist the nation's cities to become prepared to deal with a major terrorist attack. Just as the administration had shortchanged the creation of the new department, it sought to keep aid to police, fire, and other emergency responders as constrained as possible under the circumstances. So when former Senator Warren Rudman asked me, following my departure from the White House, to join him in worrying about how we train and equip our first responders to deal with weapons of mass destruction attacks, I eagerly agreed to do so. What we uncovered was disturbing. The program to train and equip first responders, which had started in the late 1990s, had not grown sufficiently, even after the disasters of September 11th. Our estimates indicate that only 25% of the needed funds were being requested by the administration. When our report, Emergency Responders, Drastically Underfunded, Dangerously Unprepared, was released, an administration spokesman dismissed it as probably calling for gold-plated telephones. Warren Rudman responded to the criticism by telling a House committee, "We don't want gold-plated telephones. We just want reliable communication devices, so that we never again lose hundreds of firemen because they couldn't hear the evacuation order, as happened in the World Trade Center." We called for $98 billion over 5 years, plus an unquantified amount for assisting local police, over and above the administration's requests. As Warren Rudman put it to me, "We need a transparent process that says you can get this much done for this much money over these many years. Without that, these guys in the White House are just pulling the Homeland Security budget out of their ass." The simple truth is that the administration does not have any idea how much money is needed because it has never tried to find out. The Bush administration contends that the additional resources we sought for aiding our first responders simply do not exist. Yet, in the war on terrorism, we are spending in Iraq in the first year of war and occupation 6 times what the Rudman study called for as an annual supplement to equip our defenders here at home. The resources for Iraq did not exist either. The administration chose to run up the national debt to pay for Iraq, but not to pay for what our police and fire personnel need to defend us here at home. Prioritizing the vulnerabilities to be reduced and figuring out a way of paying for the effort would be a major national challenge on a par with the space race or the rearming for the Cold War. It should have been the focus of a great national debate and mobilization. It wasn't. And despite the global war on terrorism, and despite or because of the war on Iraq, we are also still highly vulnerable to terrorism. The second agenda item, post-September 11th, for implementing a successful and comprehensive counterterrorism effort, should have been the creation of a counterweight ideology to the Al-Qaeda fundamentalist radical version of Islam, because much of the threat we face is ideological, a perversion of a religion. Unfortunately, there is often silence, or at best a weak and incoherent voice, countering the apparently attractive appeal of the radical mullahs. When colleagues in the White House asked me what to read to understand the problem after September 11th, I urged them instead to get an old black-and-white French film, The Battle of Algiers. In the movie, French counterterrorism authorities round up all the known terrorist managers and leaders. Sound familiar? But they lose the war with the terrorists because they do not address the ideological underpinnings. After the known terrorist leaders were arrested, time passed, and new, unknown terrorists emerged. We are likely to face the same situation with Al-Qaeda. The only way to stop it is to work with leaders of Islamic nations to ensure that tolerance of other religions is taught again, that their people believe they have fair opportunities to participate in government and the economy, that the social and cultural conditions that breed hatred are bred out. Rather than seeking to work with the majority in the Islamic world to mold Muslim opinion against the radicals' values, we did exactly what Al-Qaeda said we would do. We invaded and occupied an oil-rich Arab country that posed no threat to us, while paying scant time and attention to the Israeli-Palestinian problem. I was no fan of Saddam Hussein. Indeed, I know that in one sense the world is better off without him in power. But not the way it was done. Not by diverting us from eliminating Al-Qaeda and its clones. Not by using the funds we needed to eliminate our vulnerabilities to terrorism at home. Not at the incredibly high price of increasing Muslim hatred of America and strengthening Al-Qaeda. Former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill has written that the administration planned early on to eliminate Saddam Hussein. From everything I saw and heard, he is right. The administration of the second George Bush did begin with Iraq on its agenda. So many of those who had made the decisions in the first Iraq war were back. Cheney, Powell, Wolfowitz. Some of them had made clear in writings and speeches while out of office that they believed the United States should unseat Saddam, finish what they failed to do the first time. President Bush has said that September 11th was a turning point in his thinking about Iraq, but all along it seemed inevitable that we would invade Iraq. Iraq was portrayed as the most dangerous thing in national security. It was a decision already made, and one that no fact or event could derail. The reasons given by the Bush administration for its war with Iraq have shifted from terrorism to weapons of mass destruction to the suffering of the Iraqi people. Five rationales are attributed to three senior advisors, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Wolfowitz, and to President Bush. To clean up the mess left by the first Bush administration, to improve Israel's strategic position, to create an Arab democracy that could serve as a model, to permit the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Saudi Arabia, and to create another friendly source of oil for the U.S. market. I believe all of those motivations were at work. Most of them reflect a concern with the long-term stability of the House of Saud. In addition, particularly for President Bush, I think there was a felt need to do something big to respond to the events of September 11th. A signal that said, "Don't mess with Texas," or America. Unfortunately, invading Iraq turned out to be something other than what President Bush and his inner circle had hoped it would be. The decision to invade Iraq in 2003, largely unilaterally, was both mistaken and costly. The costs were in lives, in money, but even more important, in opportunities lost, and in future problems created or aggravated. The clearest indication of the depth of President Bush's understanding and of his own motivations came in Diane Sawyer's interview with Bush on ABC TV. Sawyer asked Bush about, quote, "the hard fact that they were weapons of mass destruction, as opposed to the possibility that Saddam might move to acquire those weapons," unquote. The president's considered response was, "What's the difference?" Then he added, "The possibility that he could acquire weapons. If he were to acquire weapons, he would be the danger." Sawyer pressed on, noting that in addition to the weapons issue, there was a failure to establish proof of elaborate terrorism contacts, and that this was at best a lack of precision and misleading at worst. The president replied, "Yeah, look, what we based our evidence on was a very sound national intelligence estimate." Could it not have been more precise? Sawyer wondered. Bush responded, I made my decision based upon enough intelligence to tell me this country was threatened with Saddam Hussein in power. Valiantly, Sawyer asked again, "What would it take to convince you there were no weapons of mass destruction?" Again, Bush replied with his mantra, "America is a safer country." Finally, in exasperation, the president said, "I'm telling you I made the right decision for America, because Saddam Hussein used weapons of mass destruction and invaded Kuwait." And so Bush invaded Iraq in 2003 because Saddam had used weapons of mass destruction in the 1980s and had invaded Kuwait in 1990. Bush concluded on the subject with Diane Sawyer, saying again that his invasion of Iraq means America's a more secure country. In fact, with our army stretched to the breaking point, our international credibility at an all-time low, Muslims further radicalized against us, our relations with key allies damaged, and our soldiers in a shooting gallery, it is as hard to believe that America is safer for the invasion as it is to believe that President Bush had good intelligence on weapons of mass destruction, or that this country was threatened with Saddam Hussein in power. As Weapons Inspector David Kay was forced to admit, quote, "We were all wrong, probably," unquote. Both the White House and CIA must have known there was no imminent threat to the United States, but one claimed the opposite, and the other allowed them to do so, uncorrected. In his famous Top Gun moment on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln, the president claimed that the invasion of Iraq was just one battle in the war on terrorism that began on September 11th. It's not hard to understand why, after repeatedly hearing remarks like that, 70% of the American people believed that Saddam Hussein had attacked the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. I suspect that many of the heroic U.S. troops who risked their lives fighting in Iraq thought, because of misleading statements from the White House, that they were avenging the 3,000 dead from September 11th. Only in September 2003, only after occupying Iraq, did the president clearly state that there was no evidence that Iraq was involved in the September 11th attacks. That new clarity must have come as a disappointing shock to American troops being targeted by snipers and blown up by landmines in Iraq. After President Bush was forced to admit publicly that there was no connection between the Al-Qaeda attack of September 11th and Saddam Hussein's government in Iraq, advocates of the Iraq War began to shift their argument. They began to emphasize the connections and linkages between Iraq and Al-Qaeda in general. When challenged in congressional testimony, Undersecretary of Defense Doug Feith promised to produce the intelligence that demonstrated the link. Not only did he send a memo to a congressional committee with a précis of dozens of such intelligence reports, someone leaked the highly classified memo to a neoconservative magazine. Neoconservative commentators then pointed to the illegally leaked document as conclusive proof of the Al-Qaeda-Iraq nexus. For those uninitiated in how to read raw intelligence reports, the Feith memo might have been persuasive. For those who have read thousands of such reports over many years, the Feith memo proved little. The Washington Post quoted longtime Defense Intelligence Agency expert Pat Lang as saying the memo was, quote, "a listing of a mass of unconfirmed reports," unquote, many of which actually proved that Al-Qaeda and Iraq had not succeeded in establishing a modus vivendi. The simple fact is that lots of people, particularly in the Middle East, pass along many rumors, and they end up being recorded and filed by U.S. intelligence agencies in raw reports. That does not make them intelligence. If there were evidence of Iraq giving funds or safe haven to Al-Qaeda before the invasion, the administration would have produced it. There is, of course, evidence that Iran provided Al-Qaeda safe haven before and after September 11th. There is also evidence that Saudis provided Al-Qaeda with funds. Any Iraqi link to Al-Qaeda is a minor footnote when compared to the links with other regimes. Another issue. For most of 2003, the actual number of U.S. troops in the Iraqi theater, which includes support units in Kuwait, was about 150,000. Many military analysts believe the number too small. This difference of opinion is more than a numbers game. If there are too few U.S. troops to secure convoy routes or to spot snipers, then U.S. military personnel are killed and wounded by Iraqi bombs, landmines, and bullets. It's worth recalling that Secretary of Defense Les Aspin was driven from office in 1993 because, it was charged, he had not provided U.S. troops in Somalia with what they needed to protect themselves, and 17 U.S. soldiers were killed. In the months of the Iraqi occupation, hundreds of U.S. military personnel have been killed, and many others wounded, in part because there were not enough U.S. military assets to spot snipers and landmines. There are additional costs of getting the occupation force estimate wrong. Producing the 150,000 U.S. forces in the Iraqi theater has badly stretched the army. National Guard and Reserve personnel have been mobilized for extended service, disrupting the lives of tens of thousands who counted on their civilian salaries to pay mortgages and other family expenses. The irony is that during the 2000 presidential campaign, the Bush team charged that peacekeeping missions had overstretched the U.S. Army. They noted that battalions that had been engaged in peacekeeping were not passing inspections because they had not been able to keep up with training proficiency and testing. By those measures, the Bush administration has now far more badly damaged the United States Army. The condition of the Army is of concern because, unlike Iraq, which showed no signs of attacking us, North Korea regularly threatens us with war. If that were to happen, with the Army tied down in Iraq and our reserves stretched, the outcome might not be favorable. Before the war, the administration gave the impression to Iraqis who were closely watching that we had only a problem with Saddam and his sons, plus a handful of others. The message sent to Iraqi commanders through a variety of creative means was, "Don't fight. Just let us get rid of Saddam." Because of those messages, many Iraqi commanders did not fight and actually sent their troops home. Yet, after Jerry Bremer was appointed proconsul of Iraq, the U.S. had another message: "You're all fired." Not only did the United States announce it was dismissing the Iraqi Army Officer Corps, it went on to relieve anyone who was a member of the Ba'ath Party from any job they might hold. The hundreds of thousands of people affected by this bait and switch were then told that the pensions they had planned on when hitting retirement age would not be there. It is little wonder that U.S. popularity plummeted and critical infrastructures and services in Iraq stopped working. It is difficult for the world's sole superpower to be popular, but it's not impossible. A superpower has different responsibilities and perspectives than other nations, but many other nations' governments and peoples will understand and sympathize if they believe the superpower is a good global citizen that respects the rights and opinions of other nations. I thought this was the concept behind candidate Bush's call for a more humble U.S. foreign policy, presumably one more humble than the Bill Clinton foreign policy. That thought seemed to be lost quickly after candidate Bush became President Bush. It was not just that the United States objected to the Kyoto Treaty on the Environment or the International Criminal Court, both things to which we should object. It was the arrogance in the way we objected. At a meeting with my staff in the summer of 2001, I suggested, if these guys in this administration are going to want an international coalition to invade Iraq next year, they're sure not making a lot of friends. The invasion, when it came in 2003, lost us many friends. In Muslim countries, the U.S. invasion of Iraq increased support for Al-Qaeda and radical anti-Americanism. Elsewhere, we were now seen as a super bully more than a superpower. When the United States next needs international support, when we need people around the world to believe that action is required to deal with Iranian or Korean nuclear weapons, who will join us? Who will believe us? Even more damaging is the loss of credibility that the national security institutions have suffered among our own people. Americans now know that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with September 11th, that there was no imminent threat from Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, that there was a secret sticker shock about the costs of war in lives and dollars. It is important that the trust in America's word be restored, essential that we return to dealing with the real threats. Unless we address these real problems, we will suffer again. Instead of energetically pursuing the priority of creating an ideological counterweight for Al-Qaeda, we invaded Iraq and gave Al-Qaeda exactly the propaganda fuel it needed. So much for the second of the three priorities that we should have been pursuing after September 11th. Our third priority should have been to strengthen several key governments that are at risk to al-Qaeda, or, in the case of Iran, are already in the hands of terrorists that have supported al-Qaeda. The first country to require our attention would have been, and was, Afghanistan, the al-Qaeda sanctuary then run by the Taliban. Following the al-Qaeda attacks on America, the war that the U.S. fought in Afghanistan was not the rapid, no-holds-barred operation that one might have expected. We did not immediately send U.S. forces to capture al-Qaeda and Taliban leadership. The Bush administration decided to continue appeals to the Taliban to turn over bin Laden and his followers. And then, when we attacked, we treated the war as a regime change rather than a search-and-destroy operation against terrorists. More than a month after the U.S. opened the military operation, the Taliban leader Mullah Omar, still alive and well, ordered his troops to pull out of Kabul and move to the mountains. No U.S. troops gave chase. Not until November 25th, 7 weeks after starting the operation, did the United States insert a ground force unit, U.S. Marines, to take and hold a former al-Qaeda and Taliban facility near Kandahar. The late November operation did not include any effort by U.S. forces to seal the border with Pakistan, snatch the al-Qaeda leadership, or cut off the al-Qaeda escape route. The Northern Alliance continued to bear most of the burden of the fighting for the U.S. in November. Under growing criticism that the Pentagon was bungling the job of getting bin Laden and the al-Qaeda leadership, Secretary Rumsfeld said, just before Christmas, that in the future, U.S. forces would do the job, rather than continuing to rely upon Afghans. By March 2002, U.S. ground forces had arrived in unit strength, and, almost 5 months after the U.S. initiated combat, began a sweep of mountainous areas to capture al-Qaeda personnel. Although Operation Anaconda ran into serious resistance, it failed to capture al-Qaeda leaders. 2 years after the U.S. began military operations against Afghanistan, U.S. forces, CIA officers, and pro-U.S. Afghans had still not found Osama bin Laden or his deputy, Ayman Zawahiri. Nor had they found Taliban leader Mullah Omar. Indeed, long before the two-year mark, the U.S. military had shifted its focus to Iraq. Of the combined U.S. forces fighting the war on terrorism in the Afghan and Iraqi theaters, only about 5% were in Afghanistan. The CIA was less tentative. As then CIA counterterrorism director Kofor Black explained to a Senate committee, quote, "After September 11th, the gloves came off," unquote. He did not explain why they were on before then. It could be argued that they were waiting for the Bush administration to determine its policy on al-Qaeda and the priority it would give to that policy. What the CIA did so readily after September 11th, however, was what the Clinton administration White House had been pressing them to do for years: insert CIA personnel into Afghanistan, aid the Northern Alliance, fly the Predator, work with other security services to identify and break up cells in Europe, the Middle East, and elsewhere. The CIA had not acted before because the career managers of its Directorate of Operations were risk-averse. The CIA had been subject to criticism when past White House staffs had gotten them involved in the civil war in Lebanon, in trading arms for hostages with Iran, in supporting Latin American militaries fighting communists and trampling human rights. Secretary Albright, reflecting on the history of the CIA, said to me that it was easy to understand why it was risk-averse. "It acts in a passive-aggressive way," she said, "as if it has battered child syndrome." What should the administration have done about Afghanistan after September 11th? The United States should have inserted forces into Afghanistan to cut off bin Laden's escape routes and to find and arrest or kill him and his deputies. America and its coalition partners, including France and Germany, should have established a security presence throughout the country. They did not. As a result, after initial efforts to unite the country, American interest waned, and the warlords returned to their old ways. Afghanistan was a nation raped by war and factional fighting for 20 years. It needed everything rebuilt. But in contrast to funds sought for Iraq, U.S. economic and development aid to Afghanistan was inadequate and slowly delivered. Because of a lack of attention and resources, Afghanistan is still a potential sanctuary for terrorists. The second country in need of significant U.S. help to prevent its fall to al-Qaeda-like groups is Pakistan. After the attacks on America, and despite the popularity of al-Qaeda in parts of Pakistan, General Musharraf courageously pressed his agencies to help the U.S. find any al-Qaeda presence in the country. Yet, to this day, Osama bin Laden is a popular icon in Pakistan. Mosques and affiliated madras schools in Pakistan teach hatred of America and all that is not Islam. Large areas of Pakistan along the Afghan border are still not controlled by the central government and offer sanctuary to the Taliban and al-Qaeda. All of this is true about a country that also has nuclear weapons. More disturbing are reports that some scientists who had worked on Pakistan's nuclear program are also al-Qaeda sympathizers and have discussed their expertise with al-Qaeda, Libya, Iran, North Korea, and others. Nothing, and certainly not Iraq, can be more important than stopping al-Qaeda from getting its hands on a nuclear weapon. Once an example of an Islamic democracy with a high-tech future, Pakistan could become what bin Laden dreams of. An Islamic nation controlled by radicals, with popular support for fundamentalism and terrorism, armed with nuclear weapons. For now, under General Musharraf, the nuclear weapons are reportedly under tight control. Musharraf, however, needs help to turn the popular attitude in his country from supporting al-Qaeda's view of the future to supporting a modern, democratic, peaceful view of the future. Although the U.S. increased assistance to Pakistan in 2001, it is inadequate to make the difference needed, to turn the tide in Pakistan and return it to stability. On a 2003 visit to the United States, General Musharraf complained that the U.S. was offering him military assistance funds, which he did not need, and not providing the economic development he desperately required. Saudi Arabia is the third of the priority nations. For several years prior to September 11th, the United States government provided the Saudis with information about al-Qaeda members in the kingdom. That information seemed to disappear into a black box. There was some greater cooperation after September 11th, but why the lethargy, the reluctance, the denial? For Americans to understand the Saudi government's attitude over the last few years, it may be easiest to explain by analogy. What might Washington's attitude be if some country alleged that the Opus Dei religious sect of Roman Catholicism were engaged in terrorism around the world and had to be destroyed, its leaders killed or arrested? Without even looking at the evidence offered by the foreign government, some in the government in Washington would say that they agreed with the basic beliefs of Opus Dei. Some in sensitive government jobs might even be members of Opus Dei and thus reluctant to arrest their co-believers. The analogy is imprecise. Opus Dei is not engaged in terrorism. But it is certainly true that the core al-Qaeda beliefs are not very different from those of many leading Saudis. Did the Saudi government knowingly provide funding and support for al-Qaeda? It is a large and wealthy government not known for transparency or exacting audits. I doubt any minister or senior member of the royal family supported the attacks on the United States. Indeed, there is evidence that there were ineffectual efforts to control bin Laden. But it must also be said that ministers and members of the royal family did knowingly support the global spread of Wahhabist Islam, jihads, and anti-Israeli activities. They ignored anti-American teaching in and around the mosques and schools where intolerance was indoctrinated. After the truck bomb attacks in Riyadh in 2003, the Saudi security services appear to have been ordered to root out al-Qaeda in the kingdom. Not surprisingly to American counterterrorism experts, the Saudi security services have become involved in gun battles and street chases. They have uncovered large arms caches, not intended for jihad elsewhere, or for attacks on U.S. facilities in the kingdom, but almost certainly intended for guerrilla war in Saudi Arabia, a war intended to replace the House of Saud. The fall of the House of Saud would not come as a shock to many senior American officials who have followed the Middle East for years. Stung by the fall of the Shah of Iran in 1979 and its replacement with an anti-American theocracy, many American officials have feared a repeat performance of that tragedy across the Gulf in Saudi Arabia. This fear probably played a role in the thinking of some in the Bush administration, including Dick Cheney, who wanted to go to war with Iraq. With Saddam gone, they believed, the U.S. could reduce its dependence on Saudi Arabia, could pull forces out of the kingdom, and could open up an alternative source of oil. Former CIA Director Jim Woolsey has talked publicly about the need for a new government in Riyadh. The risk that the United States runs is of creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. Removing the American mandate of heaven from the House of Saud without a plan or any influence about what would happen next. President Bush chose to deliver a lecture in Washington about the importance of democracy for Arab states. Coming as it did from a president widely hated in the Arab world for his invasion to impose a U.S.-style democracy in Iraq, the words of the president's lecture did little to stimulate a positive response. Indeed, because the U.S. apparently believes in imposing its ideology through the violence of war, many in the Arab world wonder how the United States can criticize the fundamentalists, who also seek to impose their ideology through violence. Iran, the fourth of the priority countries, is as important as the others in the war on terrorism. When the Bush administration talked about Iraq as a nation that supported terrorism, including Al-Qaeda, and was developing weapons of mass destruction, those comments perfectly suited Iran, not Iraq. While Iraq's weapons of mass destruction proved elusive to UN inspectors, and later to US troops, the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency found evidence that Iran was secretly engaging in a nuclear weapons program. Iran was much more actively engaged with terrorism and weapons of mass destruction than Iraq. This is not meant as an argument for invading Iran. It is, however, an argument for paying attention to real threats. Many of these threats, like Iran, require thoughtful, imaginative, and careful responses. There are strong, active democratic forces in Iran. Without destroying their credibility by making them agents of the CIA, the United States, working with other nations, should be able to strengthen these democratic forces in Iran. If we do not shift attention back to where it should have been after September 11th, we face the prospect of the following scenario by 2007. A Taliban-like government in Pakistan, armed with nuclear weapons, supporting a similar satellite nation next door in Afghanistan, and promoting Al-Qaeda-like ideology and terror throughout the world. In the Gulf, a nuclear-armed Iran, promoting its own version of Hezbollah-styled ideology. And Saudi Arabia, after the fall of the House of Saud, creating its own version of a 14th-century theocratic republic. Under those circumstances, even if we had created a Jeffersonian democracy in Iraq, America and the world would still be vastly less secure. Moreover, it appeared early in 2004 that Iraq would be shaped more by the thoughts of Shia leader Ayatollah Sistani than by Jefferson. September 11th brought both tragedy all too painful and an opportunity unexpected. There was an opportunity to unite people around the world around a set of shared values: religious tolerance, diversity, freedom, and security. We squandered the opportunity. Many around the world also feared that the world's only remaining superpower would lash out, destabilizing nations and regions. America, after all, spends more money on its weapons and military than the next seven nations combined. Would a system that tolerated such spending act like a muscle-bound cowboy, or, as the French feared, a hyperpower? Many in the Muslim world feared that America would, despite its promises, strike out against Islamic regimes and make Professor Sam Huntington's Clash of Cultures theory a self-fulfilling prophecy. Our leadership fell into the trap, fulfilling all of the worst fears of many around the world and here at home. Rather than seek to cultivate a unified global consensus to destroy the ideological roots of terrorism, we did, in fact, lash out in a largely unilateral and entirely irrelevant military adventure against a Muslim nation. It has left us less secure. After September 11th, Americans were asked to shop, not to sacrifice. Far from being asked to pay additional taxes to fund the war on terrorism, Americans were told that they would pay fewer taxes, and we would pay for the war and additional security by passing on the costs to our grandchildren. The consensus against terrorism was shattered by such overreaching as the arrest of American citizens in the United States and their designation as enemies to be denied lawyers and due process. The Attorney General, rather than bringing us together, managed to persuade much of the country that the needed reforms of the Patriot Act were actually the beginning of fascism. Rather than seriously and systematically addressing the real security vulnerabilities in this country, the administration succumbed to political pressure to reorganize agencies amid the war on terrorism and created a massive bureaucracy. Unwilling to fund security upgrades at necessary levels, the administration funded pork barrel procurement of high-tech weapons for small towns, while police and fire personnel were laid off in high-threat cities. September 11th erased memories of the unique process whereby George Bush had been selected as president a few months earlier. Now, as he stood with an arm around a New York fireman, promising to get those who had destroyed the World Trade Center, he was every American's president. His polls soared. He had a unique opportunity to unite America, to bring the United States together with allies around the world, to fight terrorism and hate, to eliminate al-Qaeda, to eliminate our vulnerabilities, to strengthen important nations threatened by radicalism. He did none of those things. He invaded Iraq. We went off on a tangent, off after Iraq, off on a path that weakened us and strengthened the next generation of al-Qaeda's. For even as we have been attriting the core al-Qaeda organization, it has metastasized. It was like a hydra growing new heads. There have been far more major terrorist attacks by al-Qaeda and its regional clones in the 30 months since September 11th than there were in the 30 months prior to that momentous event. President Bush asked us, soon after September 11th, for cards or charts of senior al-Qaeda managers, as though dealing with them would be like a Harvard Business School exercise in a hostile takeover. He announced his intentions to measure progress in the war on terrorism by crossing through the pictures of those caught or killed. I have a disturbing image of him sitting by a warm White House fireplace, drawing a dozen red X's on the faces of the former al-Qaeda corporate board, and soon perhaps on the face of Osama bin Laden, while the new clones of al-Qaeda are working the back alleys and dark warrens of Baghdad, Cairo, Jakarta, Karachi, Detroit, and Newark, using the scenes from Iraq to stoke the hatred of America even further, recruiting thousands whose names we will never know, whose faces will never be on President Bush's little charts, not until it is again too late. The nation needed thoughtful leadership to deal with the underlying problems, September 11th reflected. Instead, America got unthinking reactions, ham-handed responses, and a rejection of analysis in favor of received wisdom. It has left us less secure. We will pay the price for a long time. Epilogue. As I said in the beginning, this book is my story from my memory. It has helped me to tell it. I needed to tell you that we tried hard to stop the big al-Qaeda attack. That the professionals who sat at the counterterrorism security group table cared and would have given our own lives if that could have stopped the attacks. I had to admit that, strident as I was about the al-Qaeda threat, I did not resign in protest when my recommendations to bomb the Al-Qaeda infrastructure were deferred by the Clinton administration, or my appeals for urgent action were ignored by the Bush administration. Perhaps I should have. I needed to tell you why I think we failed and why I think America is still failing to deal with the threat posed by terrorists distorting Islam. Time is slipping by, in which the new follow-on Al-Qaedas are gaining in strength in scores of countries. Time is passing, but yet our vulnerabilities to attack at home remain. Terrorism, which never once was addressed by the presidential candidates in 2000, will be a major topic in the 2004 campaign. Already, as I write this, before the candidates have been nominated, President Bush is telling fundraisers, illogically, that he deserves money for his re-election because he is, quote, fighting the terrorists in Iraq so that we don't have to fight them in the streets of America, unquote. He never points out that our being in Iraq does nothing to prevent terrorists from coming to America, but does divert funds from addressing our domestic vulnerabilities and does make terrorist recruitment easier. If, as I suspect will happen, Bush is re-elected, I shudder to think what additional errors he will make in the next 4 years to strengthen Al-Qaeda follow-ons, attacking Syria or Iran, undermining the Saudi regime without a plan for a successor state. Most Americans, and most in the American government, still think that the great superpower cannot be defeated by a gang of religious zealots who want a global theocracy, a 14th century caliphate. Never underestimate the enemy. Our current enemy is in it for the long haul. They are smart and they are patient. Defeating them will take creativity and imagination, as well as energy. It will be the struggle of the Friends of Freedom and civil liberties around the world. As Americans, it is up to all of us to be well-informed and thoughtful to help our country make the right decisions in this time of testing. We all need to recommit ourselves to that ancient pledge to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies.
Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror, was written and read by Richard A. Clark. It was abridged for audio by George Truitt. The recording engineer was Erica Weintraub. Post-production by Stephen Strassman. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Suzanne Wetzel. Against All Enemies was produced and directed by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.